Chapter 11. The Implosion of Individualism. Perhaps no other conception of life played such an important role in the construction of modern society as the rise of individualism. In fact, many economists work on the premise that modern economy assumes an extreme individualism. First expressed in the writings of Thomas Hobbes, 1588 to 1679, the concepts that later gave rise to individualism radically changed our idea of society. No longer considered a community of individuals ordered to the perfection of man's nature, Hobbes saw society as a sand heap of individuals, each guided by his own self-interest and kept in order by a strong rule of law. Individualism is a fundamental part of our own American culture and identity. It is the foundation of the cooperative union that serves as our dominant model. Individualism is popularized as a belief in the dignity and sacredness of the individual, whereby one thinks and does as one wishes. Like technology, it also is enshrined as sacred in our secular pantheon, since any violation of this right to do as one pleases is viewed as not only morally wrong, but sacrilegious. This individualism now has its own points of tension and contradiction that put it in a state of crisis. Individuality versus individualism. We make a distinction between individuality and individualism. Man manifests his individuality when he fully develops his personality and talents by which he is different from others. At the same time, individuality encourages man to develop his intensely social character by participating in life together in community, acknowledging a moral law, and promoting the common good. The more specific, richer, and stronger this personal life, the more intense the social life. Thus, individuality results in stronger community. Individualism is a deformation of individuality by which man makes himself the center of an enclosed world of personal self-interest that tends to disregard the social character of man and his role in community. The autonomous man. First, let us analyze the substance of individualism so as to disentangle it from its myths and simplifications. Individualism is much more than just doing as one pleases. Rather, it is a philosophy of life that declares self-preservation and its corollary, self-interest, to be the most common and inalienable of all rights and the root of all morality and justice. There are, then, no absolute or unconditional duties, writes Leo Strauss of this system. Duties are binding only to the extent to which their performance does not endanger our self-preservation. Only the right of self-preservation is unconditional or absolute. Hence, according to this vision, we are all involved in our own inebriating pursuit of self-interest. Each is a totally autonomous self-made man, who is the sole architect of his own freedom and destiny. Each is a being of infinite possibility, completely free to construct an eternally new self. Footnote: individualists are divided on the true meaning of individualism. The English school tends to take a more natural, less reasoned and spontaneous attitude towards human action. The French school is rationalist and Rousseauan. Both contain this idea of self-interest and self-determination. In this grandiose conception of self, this self-made man sees himself as the product of his own personal ingenuity and strength. He is the ultimate judge of what is right and wrong. This opinion can be found in the U.S. Supreme Court decision, Planned Parenthood of Southeastern Pennsylvania versus Casey. Quote, "At the heart of liberty is the right to define one's own concept of existence, of meaning, of the universe, and of the mystery of human life," unquote. In this search, writes Daniel Bell, "there is a denial of any limits of boundaries to experience. It is a reaching out for all experience. Nothing is forbidden. All is to be explored." This concept holds that an individual becomes a perfect and complete being when unencumbered by strong ties to tradition, family, custom, or moral law. Such a vision sees everyone as being equally and entirely free of special obligations to one another. When working with or even under others, we engage in a social contract or partnership where each seeks one's own advantage or pleasure. Even the state is seen as a mere mechanism to facilitate these contracts in the pursuit of self-interest. We note that, like technology, the giddy freedom promised by individualism also has unintended practical consequences that have led to disillusionment and crisis. Alas, man is too much of a social being to endure individualism in its pure form. His human nature craves the richness of the very social bonding from which he is liberated by individualism. He perceives the limits of his lonely search for his own destiny. He finds that the unencumbered self easily becomes an impoverished and empty self. He senses the difficulty in engaging in what Hobbes calls a war of every man against every man, which leads to the tension of looking upon others with suspicion and as competitors. Society is atomized. Thus, individualism brings about two contrary movements, isolation and conformity. In the absence of any objectifiable criteria of right and wrong, good or evil, writes sociologist Robert Bella et al., the self and its feelings become our only moral guide. Far from unencumbering this self-made man, individualism actually isolates him like an atom. His lone search for self-fulfillment ends up encapsulating him inside his own self-enclosed micro-world, where he is entirely free within its limited domains in glorious but terrifying isolation. Living as an isolated atom actually gives a sensation of emptiness, anonymity, and loneliness that is profoundly anti-natural. Man's social nature is such that the frustrated individual, asphyxiated by his enclosure, cannot live up to his imagined self-aggrandizement. He must look for solace outside. Thus, we reach a great paradox. No longer having tradition, community, or social mores to sanction his judgments or measure his achievements, the self-made man turns to conformity with those similar atoms around him for validation. Thrown into society as isolated human beings, literally individua and human atoms, people hunger for integration, and they allay this hunger by means of the intoxicating thrills and crowds of mass society, writes economist Wilhelm Rupke. That is to say, the great individualist who takes great pride in being free to do everything usually ends up doing what others are doing. This is how the masses are formed. The individualist becomes what is called the other-directed man, constantly gauging himself by what he perceives are the reactions of the other anonymous atoms that make up the masses. Since these perceptions are not always clear, the individualist feels the insecurity of never knowing exactly where he stands. The implicit messages contained in media advertising and television programs essentially play on this insecurity of individualists. All are led to believe that security is found in mass-produced products and their corresponding lifestyles, whereby they can become like smiling celebrities. Worse yet, they believe they are crafting for themselves unique lives of success and happiness by their own choices. In reality, they are merely integrating themselves into our mass society by conforming to what every other atom thinks. In such an atmosphere, life, work, and even politics come to be molded by the spectacular and theatrical, since it is the only way to call people out of their isolation and convey the sense of universal happiness to be found in being part of the masses. With few mediating social structures, the individualist, like a grain of sand, suffers himself to join the anonymous masses by allowing himself to be directed by mass media, mass culture, mass markets, or even big government. In promising individualism, modernity paradoxically delivers its own stifling brand of collectivism. Freedom is not choice. There are those who confuse freedom with choice. They do not realize that freedom is the ability to choose the means to a determined end, perceived as good and in accordance with our nature. It is not the choice itself. When a person makes a bad choice or chooses a bad end, the result is not freedom, but a type of slavery to the passions. Thus, a person who overeats when satisfying natural hunger, or another who chooses an excellent wine with the intent of getting drunk, does not exercise true freedom, but rather its abuse. The more we master our nature, the more freedom we have. Supernatural virtue gives us yet more freedom, since we not only master our nature, but surpass it. St. Thomas teaches, "But man is by nature rational. When, therefore, he acts according to reason, he acts of himself and according to his free will, and this is liberty. Whereas, when he sins, he acts in opposition to reason, is moved by another, and is the victim of foreign misapprehensions. Therefore, whosoever committeth sin is the slave of sin." Practical consequences: the demise of community. One major consequence of our mass culture is that we no longer see ourselves as social beings, but rather as the center of a separate little world, with no essential need of betterment through society. In such a vision, notes philosopher Alasdair MacIntyre, we see in the social world nothing but a meeting place for individual wills, each with its own set of attitudes and preferences, and who understand that world solely as an arena for the achievement of their own satisfaction, who interpret reality as a series of opportunities for their enjoyment. That is why extreme individualism leads to the demise of community. This can be seen, for example, in the aftermath of the 60s, when powerful currents swept away the remaining traditional bonds that once held the social fabric together so tightly. The result is now evident. Silently and imperceptibly, the life of communities is dissolving with shocking rapidity as most Americans withdraw from civic and community involvement and become less engaged with family, friends, and neighbors. This process is facilitated by the modern megalopolises, which, by their anonymity, make social relation more difficult and impede the natural formation of local leaderships. Nevertheless, notes Robert Putnam, no part of America, from the smallest hamlet on up the scale, has been immune from this epidemic. He observes that this anti-civic contagion is found in every social class, ethnic group, racial category, and marital status group. Types of social groups. We are not saying that the individualist is necessarily a lonely person without social relationships, association with others, a circle of family and friends suited to taste, is admitted or even encouraged by individualist thinkers. In fact, our modern world is full of organizations of all types providing numerous opportunities to interact socially. However, what we are saying is that these associations tend to be shallow. These relationships are often deliberately superficial and casual, and as a result, well suited to the individualist who links and unlinks with others according to personal whims and immediate interests. There are a vast number of legitimate and useful organizations that loosely engage the individual around specific interests. These might be organizations centered, for example, on self-help, sports, education, or stamp collecting. While these free and voluntary associations serve a purpose, they are set up without major commitments or allegiances and do not seek to define or form the person. Richard Stivers claims that mass society makes these superficial and voluntary organizations especially necessary. He notes that, with the disappearance of extended family and community, the individual requires some identity and security in relation to the centralized power of the state and corporation. These organizations differ from the family and those traditional groups of community or parish, which help define the person and are deliberately formative. Membership in these cohesive social groups plays an important role in the perfection of a person's social nature, conferring status, identity, meaning, and structure upon one without destroying individuality. This can also be seen, for example, in universities, military services, or church organizations that enhance, not absorb, the individual. While individualists might admit the usefulness of the family and intermediary groups, they do so in the pursuit of their self-interest and tend to deny this intense social context. War on cohesive communities. It is no surprise that modern individualist thinkers and politicians have waged a veritable war on these cohesive mediating groups. Such ideologues celebrate their demise as liberating and insist that the individual must reign supreme. In reality, none save the state, ultimately ends up reigning, since it is the only entity capable of absorbing, and badly carrying out, the functions of the smaller groups. The revolution's hatred of intermediary associations. Distrust of intermediary social bodies can already be seen in Hobbes' support of the strong state in his book Leviathan. Rousseau did not hide his own dislike for partial associations. In 1791, the French Revolution abolished guilds and trade corporations. It later imposed the infamous Le Chapelier Law, which, under the pretext that no corporation should stand between the individual and the state, forbade the establishment of intermediary associations. Napoleon broadened and systemized such laws when, in 1810, he extended the prohibition to include any association of over 20 persons. An uproar led to progressive relaxing of these restrictions. The controversy continued until the laws were repealed at the end of the 19th century. Even where these cohesive societies managed to survive, the alienating forces of modernity have done much to deprive them of their functions and reduce the old communal institutions of clan, village, or church to almost folklore status. More conservative individualists might even tragically turn these same cohesive societies into voluntary societies aimed at self-interest. Thus, for example, the family, stripped of its functions, comes to be considered as a mere voluntary social unit, no more or no less than any other association, to be used to advance the individual's pursuit of happiness. This can be seen in the proliferation of divorce or the demand for same-sex marriage. As mentioned before, many see the nation, which should be the supreme cohesive body, as a cooperative union from which one can take great advantage. Hostility towards the state. Individualism eventually leads to hostility towards the state. It is seen as a mere keeper of order that becomes necessary as property is accumulated. Footnote: the acquisition of valuable and extensive property, therefore, necessarily requires the establishment of civil government. Where there is no property, or at least none that exceeds the value of 2 or 3 days' labor, civil government is not necessary. Smith, Wealth of Nations, 309. For John Locke, government has no other end but the preservation of property. Its purpose is diminished to the safeguarding of those individual rights associated with self-interest. In the words of Adam Smith, civil government, so far as it is instituted for the security of property, is in reality instituted for the defense of the rich against the poor, or of those who have some property against those who have none at all. Thus, the individualist sees the state as a regulator of the social contracts that keep society running. The state is a mechanical apparatus or a mutual insurance corporation, writes Heinrich Rahman in criticism of this model. The taxes are insurance premiums, the state and its government a kind of property owners' protective association. Any set of objective moral values outside this framework has no validity. The more radical libertarians refuse to see the state as a source of social union and even long to see the state abolished entirely and have all of its regulating functions put in private hands. The socialist, on the other hand, sees the state as the supreme regulator that must plan all things. The modern state is only too eager to fill its role as regulator by establishing its intrusive presence everywhere. The state arrogates to itself the great number of tasks that once belonged to the family and other intermediary associations. The state establishes a growing presence in the economic activities of the nation, thus fostering a socialist mentality. It must have frequent recourse to an army of faceless bureaucrats that have the onerous task of regulating the action of its citizens. To this effect, it must also tax and spend, even to the point of incurring great debt. Hence, the state is no longer seen as the highest social union, the holder of legal authority, or the promoter of the common good. Rather, it plays the role of the intrusive regulator of individual interests, to be looked upon with utmost suspicion. The destruction of higher law. We also note that the individualist concept of law tends to deny the obligations to follow a higher or eternal law. This concept greatly simplifies moral law, which is based on human nature, by limiting it to merely the natural right of self-preservation. Footnote. Hobbes and others tried to deduce a law of nature, lex naturalis, based not on human nature but self-preservation, a precept or general rule found out by reason by which a man is forbidden to do that which is destructive of his life. Such law is severely limited in both scope and content, since it does not consider the role of law and justice in the perfection of our nature. If the only unconditional moral fact is the natural right of each to his self-preservation, and therefore all obligations to others arise from contract, justice becomes identical with the habit of fulfilling one's contracts, explains philosopher Leo Strauss. Justice no longer consists in complying with standards that are independent of human will. Thus, law is reduced to mere regulation, aiding individual self-interest, safeguarding property or contracts, and keeping public order. Without references to any universal principles, civil law easily embraces positivism, a philosophy that holds that the foundation of law is no longer found in natural law, but the state itself. The individualist order extends beyond simply doing what one wants. It tends to develop shallow and loose associations favorable to self-interest, but which break all those strong ties that lead to the social cohesion so necessary for our troubled times. The immense freedoms that we as Americans enjoy would gain much if we could once again acknowledge those natural social institutions that temper yet give meaning and context to this freedom. Without this recognition, far from enhancing true freedom, individualism has only served to destroy it.